This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. For the past few weeks, I've been reading from the book Eye of the Albatross by Carl Safina, subtitled Visions of Hope and Survival. We've been based on Tern Island, following a beautiful Laysan albatross female that Carl Safina has named Amelia, and she has a recently hatched chick. Albatross lay one egg about every 2 years. She and her mate take turns brooding the chick while the other flies over the ocean looking for food and then returning from hundreds of miles away, sometimes at very long intervals, a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And Amelia is carrying a satellite transmitter, and Safina is able to follow her route as she flies across the vast ocean. And Safina is kind of an ocean person himself, knows it very well, and can beautifully interpret what Amelia is doing. Looking at carlsafina.org, just under books, he's written, as well as Eye of the Albatross, Song for the Blue Ocean, Encounters Along the World's Coasts and Beneath the Seas. It's available in paperback. Voyage of the Turtle, In Pursuit of the Earth's Last Dinosaur. The Sea in Flames, The Deep Water Horizon Oil Blowout. Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. Becoming Wild, I was just picking that up and looking at it. How Animal Cultures Raise Families, Create Beauty, and Achieve Peace. Alfie and Me, What Owls Know, What Humans Believe. The View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World. And that's just his books. He's written hundreds of articles and things that you might enjoy looking at. carlsafina.org. Last week I ended with mention of the earthquake in far eastern Russia on the Kamchatka Peninsula, which was the sixth largest quake ever recorded. This was on July 29. Apparently it didn't have a big tsunami effect, probably because of the way the plates moved against each other. And I did find that Midway had a big wave come in, but not overtopping the coral reef around Midway. There's even some video you can see of the wave approaching. But I wasn't able to find anything about Tern Island, which is where this book centers itself, where Amelia is nesting in the French frigate shoals. They're much lower and smaller. One thing I did say last week, and I'll repeat it here, is that the young albatross nesting there fledged generally in mid-July, so I'm hoping that the albatross had some success this year. I'm going to read again something that's so important and so interesting, and maybe it's me and I have to hear things a bunch of times, but I think this is well worth repeating, about the evolution of atolls and of the Hawaiian Islands themselves. And then I'll read further into our book. So here's a repeat of the geology and evolution of these atolls, which I find absolutely fascinating. When sea levels were at a low point 17,000 years ago, during the last ice age, high tide was 300 feet lower than it is today. Some of today's barely drowned shallows and barely emergent atolls, like French frigate shoals, would have been substantial islands. Now there's not much margin for error. In fact, if not for the magic of coral, many of the most bird-populated atolls would already have drowned. An atoll is a roughly circular island with a central lagoon, dependent on the upward growth of corals to keep its head above water. Today, many of the northwestern Hawaiian islands are atolls. Some North Pacific atolls have been drilled to see how thick their coral cap is. It's thick, thousands of feet at certain atolls. Charles Darwin, an even greater genius than most people realize, was also first to correctly figure out the evolution of atolls. As magma rises from a hot spot or a plate boundary in Earth's mantle, a volcanic island forms. By the time formation ends, as when the island is conveyed away from the hot spot on a moving plate, the massive mountains have already begun eroding. These Hawaiian islands that have moved west of the active volcanic zone have begun this process. Over 2 to 5 million years, while the mighty island begins subsiding, a ring of corals forms around the island. In 5 to 10 million more years, as the island continues sinking, the coral forms a fringing reef. By 10 to 30 million years, the island submerges just below the sea, leaving a ring of upwardly mobile, growing coral reef and low islands around the perimeter and a shallow lagoon in the center. As long as their corals can grow fast enough to keep pace with the island sinkage and sea level rise, these will be islands and atolls. The place where the water becomes too cool for coral reefs growth to keep pace with sinkage, about 29 degrees north latitude, is called the Darwin Point. In the Hawaiian chain, it is no coincidence that Kure Atoll, at the extreme end of the northwestern islands, is both the last emergent island and the world's northernmost atoll. This is the last place where coral growth can compensate for island subsidence. The sunken emperor seamounts are the drowned islands past this point, whose fossil corals, extinguished by too cool waters, still capped the submerged lands. This fate next awaits Kure too, on its inexorable journey north, and the sea will eventually reclaim each island as it trips over the Darwin Point. I find this so interesting. I'm going to read forward now. We left Amelia last week flying over the ocean and using her nose, her incredible sense of smell, to find food on the ocean surface. A keen sense of smell is rare in birds, limited to vultures and seabirds, the tube noses. There may be some exceptions that I'm not aware of. And now Carl Safina. What to us is trackless blue ocean is to her recognizable territory, a familiar mosaic riddled with scents and signs. As we know that in our town, the supermarket will hold food, a train will come along the tracks, children will fill the schoolyard, and a bus will appear at the stop, she likewise knows the sea's vast and changing neighborhoods and what to expect. She knows when to keep going and where patience will turn to profit. She keeps going. The sun dies in solitude off to Amelia's left. She flies steadily into the deep night. As best we understand, much of this time, alternating halves of her brain are sleeping. Once, when a ship in Antarctic waters made an abrupt 90-degree turn, a wandering albatross that had been following for many hours slammed into the vessel and fell to the deck. Apparently, that bird had been totally asleep. In the morning, Amelia is 94 miles north of Turn Island. No sight of land guides her, but in a place that looks no different from any of the surrounding sea, her nose tells her to slow. Amelia is getting whiffs of a faint, earthy smell, a little like the aroma of freshly broken succulent vegetation. If she'd ever smelled a cut cucumber, it would remind her of this smell. Unseen, 220 fathoms below, the slopes of an enormous undersea mountain slump to an ocean floor 2,600 fathoms, 3 miles deep, a fathom being 6 feet, roughly the span of a man's outstretched arms. Amelia doesn't know that a mountain is forcing currents up its slopes toward the surface. She doesn't know that when water streaming up from the dark abyss is struck by sunlight, its untapped nutrients can nourish the single-celled plants that need both sunlight and nutrients, nor that these plant cells, phytoplankton, give off that faint, earthy, fresh smell. She doesn't know that small animals called zooplankton eat those plant cells, or that zooplanktons get eaten by small fish, and the little fish feed squid. She doesn't know that. She doesn't need to. She knows this, that smell means food. Amelia passes into the scent, upwind, and the air goes pure salty again. She turns and the aroma resumes. She weaves along its line of origin, and suddenly she receives a whiff of something different, very faint. It's the smell of fat. Not blubber, not the kind of feast a whale carcass would mean. This wild aroma is from sea foam, including the whipped fat of minute diatoms whose microscopic bodies have been broken by rough water. The foam has drifted into a very subtle line, a thin, diluted concentration zone formed at the surface where the current is eddying around water being deflected up the slope. A few widely scattered groups of terns and several albatrosses affirm that this place might be worth investigating, but their sparseness suggests you should have been here yesterday. Amelia searches sunlit waters over the unseen slopes. She searches all day. She comes up with precious little, not more than a few jellyfish this time. The smell that drew her in seems to have grown fainter during the day. Nothing in her experience suggests to her that this area is worth further searching. Her nose tells her that the water's temperature has been steady. The air temperature at the surface hasn't changed a whiff. The calm, hot weather hasn't brought enough wind to mix up the deeper water for full benefit. At the surface, it's still mostly the same water for miles around. This water is too blue and clear, so clear because it's so empty. She travels 90 miles farther east and goes dozy in the dark until past midnight. She catches another interesting whiff that rouses her to full wakefulness. She turns south. The scent vanishes in a slight wind shift, but she continues in this direction, and after about an hour, she briefly gets that weak scent again. She flies another hour. Now the scent strengthens. Amelia slows. She's over a larger but much deeper bulge. This one rises to 1,700 fathoms in water 2,700 fathoms deep. If there is a drift line or surface rips in the running tides or any other visual cues, they're invisible in the dark, but the scent is familiar enough. In the starlit black waters of a moonless night, she sees lanternfish flickering to each other, blinking the lights along their bodies like scouts with signaling mirrors. They're generally too small for Amelia to catch, but she knows patience here now could mean squid. Squid in the dark that have followed the lanternfish up 1,000 feet since sunset. In the inky water, those puckering hunters become the hunted. Amelia sees a small pod of squid come and go from her field of view. She wheels and sees another squid rushing small lanternfish. Several squid succeed, and as they maneuver their wriggling victims toward their beaks, they blush darker to conceal themselves and their meals from hungry schoolmates. Occupied in their own stealth and mutual mistrust, the squid fail to detect Amelia's night-cloaked gliding approach. She plows in heavily like an unseen truck speeding into a busy intersection. Suddenly, among the squid, an enemy is jabbing. Puffs of ink explode in the water like bombs in the D-Day sky. Narrowly, all the squid scatter safely away. All but one. Amelia sits watching for more squid. Patience, patience, patience is what the sea teaches, wrote Anne Morrow Lindbergh. Patience and faith. A disturbed jellyfish lights up momentarily and its glow catches Amelia's attention out of the corner of her eye. Her glance reveals several more squid prowling just under the surface. She paddles toward them, half spreading her wings because she wants to hurry, and extends her neck just in time to reach one at the edge of the withdrawing group. When she is done swallowing, she shakes her head in the cool seawater, cleansing the squid's thick, muddy ink from her fine white face. For hours and hours all day, she searches this thin broth of sustenance in the sparse tropical sea. She courses over the edges of unseen slopes deep below, following her nose and the subtle surface turbulence those slopes create in the streaming currents. A squid floats dead at the surface. Amelia lands and paddles forward, nailing it on her impaling bill. The more food Amelia finds, the more she feels her chick pulling. She can feel that new chick like a rubber band, like a downy bungee cord. Nearly 156 miles into the ocean from Tern Island, she suddenly sets course directly for home, and the satellites log the route change. For 10 hours, she sails a straight track as if connected by a taut wire to her unseen nest and her fluffy baby. The satellite has given us tracks on the map. Using everything else we know, we've filled the map with plausible details. Here at Tern, Amelia is again flesh and blood after 2 days at sea. It is February 12. It's probably safe to infer that she hasn't been satisfied with the results of her foragings, because on her next launch, only a day after arriving, she goes in the opposite direction to a place virtually no albatrosses ever go. Few of the hundreds of thousands of albatrosses from these islands head south ever, but on this trip, for some reason, Amelia does, flying directly southeast, just under 300 miles. Ocean temperature monitoring buoys placed by the U.S. government are telling satellites this story. Amelia has passed into more tropical waters. The temperature rising more than 3 degrees Celsius to 24 degrees Celsius, 75 Fahrenheit. Here, near dawn, the marbled aroma of colliding currents and the scent of schools of fishes reaches her. Fishing boats in the tropics read water temperatures assiduously. They travel hundreds of miles while looking for those temperature changes that indicate a water border and the animals it implies. They are guided by satellite image, sea surface temperature maps, faxed or downloaded on board, as well as by onboard temperature instruments. Albatrosses and fishing boat captains read clues using different methods, but they speak the same language. Amelia wanders 25 miles to the west. She wheels and backtracks back toward the marbled scents for 20 miles in the searing tropical daylight. She sees fair numbers of flying fish but catches nothing. If you want to catch flying fish for a living, you have to be either an expert plunge diver like a masked booby or a master aerialist like a red-footed booby or frigate bird. And you have to hang around predatory fishes like tunas and marlins that will flush the flying fish for you. That's not in an albatross's job description or list of qualifications. It's not the evolutionary ad they've answered. So they have to limit themselves to taking an occasional dead one. All those seabirds that attack live, agile prey in the daytime are downhill racers. Albatrosses are cross-country skiers built for economical travel. Everyone ends up back at the lodge. They just take different routes. Amelia works back northwest for another 60 miles until the sun is slanted. There, her track turns back abruptly, following a straight line southeast for 40 miles. Likely, she's found a fishing boat hunting big-eye tuna with a 40-mile long line, sending 1,000 hooks into the depths. She is following, and a dangerous game begins, trying to snatch squid from the hooks before they sink, without being hooked and drowned. She's less effective at grabbing the sinking bait in the dark, so she peels away from the boat. She continues working this area, finding a group of spawning flying fish, vulnerably oblivious in their passion near the surface of the night. For failing to pay attention to how dangerous the world can be, two fish forfeit their lives. When she feels the chick tugging and her time remaining short, she puts the trade wind into her wings and sets sail for Tern Island, still over 300 miles away. Her 24-hour track home is astonishingly direct. She appears at her nest on February 17, leaving 2 days ago. She's flown a total of 917 miles. I'll stop there. I spoke with a friend recently who worked on a long-line fishing boat going after halibut. Their lines, I think, were a mile long. The more I learn about ocean fishing vessels is, I wish everybody would give up eating ocean food, squid, eels, the list goes on and on. It's not a good game out there, unregulated in the vast ocean. I will end here. I've been reading from Carl Safina's wonderful book, Eye of the Albatross, Visions of Hope and Survival, published in 2002 by Henry Holt Publishers. It's a John Burroughs Award winner, like Those of the Forest. which turned me on to the John Burroughs Award that book did. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thanks for listening.